You're listening to OWW Radio,
the official radio show of OnlineWorldOfWrestling.com.
All right. So here we are, living it day by day. You are a superstar, and that's what you used to always be.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to this edition of OWW Radio. This is the official radio program of OnlineWorldOfWrestling.com. My name is David, and today I am joined by the NWA director, Mr. Bill Behrens. All right, Bill, thank you so much for joining the show.
Thank you.
Tell us, how did you become involved with the NWA?
I was approached, well, actually, at the time I was promoting in Nashville with Bert Prentice. We had a company at the time we were calling Music City Wrestling that had been developed after the demise of USWA. Basically, when USWA went out of business, I had a contract with WWE to deliver a TV show to them, which at the time was USWA, in which they put their commercials, and I was paid a fee to do that for quite a while. It was part of a deal that Jerry Jarrett had set up for me going back to 1993, and we had bounced back and forth between WWE being our distributor and WCW and then back to WWE, and we were back with WWE when Jerry sold and when the investors bought, and then 3 months later, USWA was out of business, and on a Monday, I had no TV show and needed one to ship by Wednesday. Jerry recommended I get in touch with Bert, who I had worked with very briefly at the tail end of USWA. In fact, we were the only two allowed to produce the final shows for USWA because everybody else was litigious and was not allowed in the studio. So I got to Bert. I said, can you come up with a show immediately? He had some Ozark Mountain stuff that was edited into a new show that we called Music City Wrestling, and we threw that up to WWE and then quickly started promoting, and off we went. Well, sometime at the, I want to say at the end of 1997, this happened about March of 97 that we started Music City, give or take, Howard Brody, who was then president of the NWA, approached us and said, would you guys like to join? You know, you guys have TV in about 50% of the country. You're doing good work. We had drawn some good houses running both Fridays and Saturdays at the Nashville Fairgrounds. So I decided to join and paid the fee at that time and attended my first annual meeting at the end of 1998. That was in New Jersey.
Now, and the NWA is really unlike anything in professional wrestling. Can you explain the concept of the NWA?
It's misunderstood periodically as being a promotion, which the NWA never was. The NWA is a sanctioning body and a brand, and that literally is the beginning, middle, and end of what it is. It then consists of members who are promoters, and that's where the identity of the NWA as a promotion comes into play, and it always was that going back to the very beginning. In general, historically, the NWA office controlled the world champion, at least, and periodically might have some control over other champions. That same kind of mentality exists today in that the executive director, previously the president, usually booked or assisted in booking the world champion and was involved in that selection process, although we added other, quote, member-controlled or executive director-controlled titles to that mix, including the North American, the National, the World Tag, World Women's, and others that are also decided by the executive director pretty much unilaterally. Back in the day, things like world champions were decided in a much more competitive process among the membership, usually at annual meetings. So basically we're a brand. It's a trademarked brand. And those of us who are members share in the brand.
Now, your world champion right now, Colt Cabana, of course, has a large following, and he's involved in a really interesting series of matches, the Seven Levels of Hate with Adam Pearce. First of all, great idea, right?
We like it right now, and not so good for Adam. He's down three to nothing, and the very next show coming up could be the last one. And, of course, Adam has said that if he does not win, he will retire from professional wrestling for good. So there's also repercussions that have been placed on this that are quite literally real, and he means it. He does intend to retire in terms of this if he is not, you know, inevitably the winner. So it could be over as early as the next series. It could go as far as seven. There are tentative dates that have been set out all the way through a seventh show. Some of that had to change recently because one promotion fell out, another one had to come in. So there we're constantly working on making sure we have backup plans based on the continuation. But it has been an interesting one, and every one of the matches is what I guess we would call a gimmick. They're all different kind of matches.
Right, street fight, first blood, that type of thing.
Yeah, very much so. So it sort of shakes it up rather than every, you know, being the same match every time, pinfall or submission, which normally is the only, you know, is pretty much it in terms of how world title matches are supposed to go. This is the intent here is to shake it up a little bit and hopefully provide a little bit more of a national interest in the chase rather than, say, it being focused just on the NWA and Hollywood television as an example.
Now, the NWA used to put on anniversary shows where the best talent from across the world would come to one location and basically perform at this showcase, talent such as James Storm, AJ Styles, etc. How difficult of a task was this to organize?
Well, there's a couple of answers to that. First of all, we suffered from the problem that it really depended on who was promoting it as to the quality, and we only really did four or five of those annual shows. We started in 98 in New Jersey. We had a good show where we had actually the WWE Dojo at the time that was being trained by Dory Funk Jr. and Tom Pritchard. It was a class that included Christian, Edge, Kurt Angle was there. I think the Hardys, I know, you know, it was a neat little match, and we also had a good card top to bottom. A little bit of drama in terms of one of the main events, which was Danny Severn versus Steven Regal, that didn't go quite that well. We had a cage match that was supposed to involve Todd Gordon that had a lot of drama. But in general, it was a good show. And then the next year we went to Charlotte, probably have an overbooked show. Too many of our individual promotion talent were involved. And it didn't, well, it showcased what we had. There was just too much. And it drew okay. We decided to make some changes. The year after that, actually, Bert Prentice and I bid for it, and we went to Nashville, and we decided to do 2 days. We did one show that showcased really the titles and some of the best of what we could deliver. And the main event of that was Mike Rapata defending the North American title, if memory serves. It could have been the heavyweight title. I can't remember which right now, against Chris Harris. And it involved appearances by Abyss as Prince Justice and another big guy named Stone Mountain who was working for me. But top to bottom, a strong card, including a match from Ohio Valley that had Flash Flanagan, Rob Conway, Nikki Dinsmore, and Damaja in it. So a lot of good talent was on that. And then we did a second day show that featured all of our member promotions with a spotlight match. And it was a little more craptastic. And that became sort of the problem we encountered, is that the quality of what all each of us was doing was not necessarily comparable to what some of us was doing.
Mm-hmm.
And so we got to the point where, even though we did two more, we did one in Tech, one in Florida that actually was pretty good, that Howard Brody promoted. That was where AJ Styles faced Chris Daniels for the first time, and where Hashimoto beat the crap out of Steve Corino. And that was a decent show, where we also had our Wildside crew attack the Florida crew, which was a pretty cool spot until the entire Florida crew no-sold it and cut promo after promo in the ring afterward, killing all the heat. But regardless, we had a good show there. We went to Texas. We had an okay show coming right after tornadoes had destroyed Corpus Christi. And then the last one we did was up in Parkersburg, West Virginia, and probably the weakest of all of them. And at that point, we sort of had a reality check and said, hey, let's really not do this anymore. The members had a tendency, some, to bring those people that would make the trip rather than necessarily the best people they had. So you weren't necessarily getting the cream of the crop. You were getting sort of the curdled milk of the crop. And we decided that wasn't a good idea, and we changed the format. By the way, we did have one more set of shows in Nashville. I forgot. Okay. But regardless, we decided to get out of that business. And for the last, golly, I want to say at least 5 to 7 years, we haven't done shows, and I think that was a better decision. We have done some shows representative of some of the best we can do. We did several shows at the Ohio State Fair, for example, that were fairly well done. And we had several touring shows we did where buildings for a while were buying shows from us. That was before the economy crashed, and those were fairly successful. Mm-hmm. And then David Marquez was promoting some shows on his own, including a pretty good one that was held at Phillips Arena in Atlanta.
So you have these organizations like NWA Wildside, NWA Anarchy, basically all under the NWA banner, correct?
Yes. You know, you've mentioned two in which I've been involved. Wildside was mine. Mm-hmm. NWA Anarchy has had three different groups running it. The most successful were Jerry Palmer, who then sold to the current promoter, Franklin Dove.
Mm-hmm.
But all of those operated out of the same small former gym, high school gym. But if you saw the size of it, you'd wonder how they competed in any sport in it. That's up in Cornelia, Georgia, very small wooden building that when you drive up to, you wonder how it generated some of the mystique it did and how it ended up being the home of so many people who are stars today, including AJ, Abyss, Hernandez, Matt Sydal, Delirious, who books Ring of Honor, and you know, the list goes on and on.
Yeah, Cornelia, Georgia has had regular pro wrestling for many years. What do you think is the secret to the success of NWA Anarchy?
It's a different kind of promotion. Most promoters, well, at least in theory, promote the show. It's, you know, butts in seats, and I'm making money. I learned a long time ago I was a pretty terrible promoter, but I was a good booker, mm-hmm. and I was good at developing talent. So I had to go a different route. When Burt Prentice was promoting in Nashville, we were successful. We would draw both Friday and Saturday nights, and in fact, we canceled Fridays at the Nashville Fairgrounds when we drew 350 people with a tag match, the Tennessee Volunteers versus Spellbinder and Brian Christopher on top. And, you know, most people today would die and go to heaven for 350 people, but that was a, golly, we can't afford this anymore kind of thing because we were used to 500-plus on Friday and 800-plus in the building on Saturday back-to-back every week. So then you flash forward, and I'm running a building that if I pack it full, I might be able to get 175 to 200 people in there, and the 200 is really stretching it. So the economics are such that we had to figure another way out. Well, one of the ways is that very few people get paid historically. I'm not known as a great payday guy, at least not in that little building, because the reality is I couldn't be. And then the second side of it is we took a different tactic. I've always had a background in television. I was a television programming executive for 20 years, working for companies like Universal Television as an officer.
Oh.
And that sort of got me into wrestling. So we created a television product and, in essence, a training ground for wrestlers as to how to perform not just in front of a crowd but on television, which most people really weren't doing, at least at the time we started, you know, back in 1998. There were companies doing television. You know, ECW obviously was, you know, had been doing some successfully. Smoky Mountain had been going and had gone out of business right around that time, and I'd been involved with them. But most of the rank and file promotions weren't doing it, and we had our television was on various small networks that reached about 50% of the country. So we had a little bit of a buzz in what we were doing. And that was the starting point. We became a training ground in a development area, and that was reinforced in 2000 and 2001 when WCW hired me to develop talent. And we ended up having a goodly number of those folk come in. Eventually, in fact, I closed Wildside at the request of literally Vince McMahon, who believed it to be competitive when I joined Deep South Wrestling for a period of time, which unfortunately didn't work out the way I wanted it to, but that was the second time I was involved directly in development. And that's, in essence, what I've been doing the whole way through. So that was the difference, really, and continues to be the difference. While the other promoters at Anarchy have aspired probably more than I to make money and were better promoters than I and drew more at the gate, the basic premise that we can only make so much out of that small building is still true. The basic premise that we can't pay much out accordingly, and if you come into these promotions And we have a crew of 30 to 40 people now, which means that people still stand in line to be part of something that generates them $5 to $20 a show.
Mm-hmm.
But they also believe they might get somewhere like Phil Shatter, now Gunner, did, like Consequences Creed, who's now in development at WWE after a run in TNA, as Xavier Woods now, and he's finally in a tag team to make it his spot. So there have been examples of people that have come through, and it's generated opportunity going all the way back to the beginning of what we started with Wildside, and that continues through Anarchy. So that's become sort of the reputation of what we do there. We're not the typical promotion. We're really a promotion that's trying to convince other people that our people are good and that they should be paid, but nobody comes into the promotions I'm involved in and thinks that's going to be their best payday ever, or at least rarely.
Mm-hmm. Well, you've been involved, as you said, in promoting and booking, in the TV side of the business, and talent development. Do you have a favorite aspect of professional wrestling?
A combo package. Tommy Dreamer, when he was head of talent relations, had a line I liked, and he said, I help people fulfill their dreams, or at least what they believe their dreams to be. And to some extent, that's really where I find my greatest pleasure is when I'm able to help somebody actually get a little bit further and help them fulfill that dream. It's a double-edged sword because the dreams can sometimes be fleeting. This is like any aspect of the entertainment business. Your time getting paid or your time of stardom may be fleeting. And even, you know, if you've made it and then you end up back on what we would call the indies again, even if you're at a higher price point, you're always going to want to get back where you were. So there's a little bit of a disappointment factor that has to be factored into the, oh my gosh, I'm getting an opportunity thing. You know, wow, I did an extra spot on WWE, or hey, I'm on Gut Check here for TNA. Those are moments. Then once those moments are over, if they don't lead to something else, then there's sort of the negative side. So that's the yin and the yang of that part of it. The other part is when you do something creatively that works,
mm-hmm,
and that suspends disbelief, and where a crowd can get emotionally and viscerally responded, whether it's violently or shock or pleasure, but it's real. The audience is really responding. You know, one of my favorite spots was near the end of Wildside, when we did an angle between a reformed Suicidal Tendencies, one of the teams that was the bread and butter with, started with Air Paris and John Phoenix and Jason Cross and Adam Jacobs. And then we had another team we called the Guys That Totally Rule. Actually, three Guys That Totally Rule, but there were five of them at the time. But the math still worked, trust me.
Mm-hmm.
And that consisted of Sal Renaro and Fast Eddie and Seth DeLay and Patrick Bentley. And then eventually, and this was where we led with this, we had really put over a young guy that eventually became a referee first at TNA and then at WWE, Mike Posey, who actually did a couple of WrestleManias at WWE as a referee.
Mm-hmm.
And he was a babyface rep. We'd had him in angles as a babyface for well over a year, including wrestling angles tied to Daisy Hayes and feuding with Sal Renaro in various ways and others, and Patrick Bentley too. And so he was recognized as the babyface and was 100% the babyface. And then we did a turn in the match where Posey refused to count and then ended up going with the heels, and the heels went over and Posey joined the Guys That Totally Rule as the official. Jimmy Rave was also involved in the match. He was the guest star, we referred to him as the international superstar because he had once toured Italy at the time. And he was involved as one of the three guys, which made up four or five by the time he got done. Patrick Bentley was called Zero X at the time, which meant that, of course, if you have three guys and you add Zero X, well, three plus zero is still three. So logically, the math worked. But when we turned, the audience did one of those, you know, yay, yay, us moments. They literally flooded the ring with garbage. And it was real. It wasn't manufactured. We had had that happen years back when we had had another Scrooge thing that, in fact, Chris Champion was the referee, and that's what, interestingly, another ref spot seemed to work for us. And a tag team out of Nashville, the New South, Ashley and Corey, were in. And that one caused a near riot that, in fact, had the police called. And there's lots more examples that have happened over the years. But those are the moments, one, helping people achieve their dreams, and the other, those times where wrestling is real again. Because wrestling in its purest form is the willing suspension of disbelief, and it's an aggressive soap opera. And if you can get that believability, then you've really accomplished something. Anybody can book two people to go in a match and come up with a finish. That's matchmaking. Booking is the process of telling stories, if you do it correctly. And when you are able to achieve something and you have an audience have a visceral response, it's what makes wrestling the art form it truly is. A lot of people undervalue wrestling. It's one of the purest improv forms there is. There's very little you can compare it to other than improv theater, improv comedy. And that doesn't carry the risk that wrestling does. People talk about staging. People talk about rehearsal. People talk about real, unreal. Nobody can truly practice a match. They may run through stuff, but what happens in the ring happens.
Mm-hmm.
And it is real accordingly. Yeah, there may be predetermination, but it's real. Everything that one of the great answers of is wrestling real? Everything you see actually happens is one of my favorite answers. Rocky Johnson gave me that once. And it's the truth. Everything you see actually happens. If somebody dives across a ring and somebody moves and they land on their face, they did that. It's real. And that's those moments where you can make wrestling as real as possible for the audience are the holy grail.
Well, for yourself, who's been in talent development a long time, can you explain why it's so hard to create top stars, to create, you know, new wrestlers that people are going to care about?
No easy answer to that, except that there is an it factor that is real. I identify it frequently in people, and I've got a pretty good indicator on it. But still, no matter what you believe and no matter who you know, no matter what rocket ship you put up somebody's butt, the reality is the fans have to agree.
Mm-hmm.
And it just depends on timing and positioning. When The Rock came in initially to WWE and was pushed immediately to Intercontinental Champion, the crowd hated him. Rocky sucks was the way they started. And it was not hate you as a heel hate. It was we don't want you here, go away heat. So they repackaged him with the Nation of Domination, downgraded his push, took time, and eventually he became a phenomenon.
Right.
They were 100% right that the star value was there, but they tried too hard too quick to get that guy to that point. Entertainment and personality, the cult of personality, is very fleeting. Popularity is very fleeting. You can become the most popular person, and then it can be 10 minutes later, you are nobody. Television shows that all the time. You know, you can always do the, in fact, there are shows that literally live on whatever happened to that guy or girl. You know, they were so popular, and then, what the hell? You know, 3 years after the show, they're done. They don't appear in a movie. We don't see them anywhere. You know, they're doing something else. And that's the same for wrestling. There's also such a gigantic talent pool that's out there, and you can only focus on a narrow group of people on the largest stages. So, and that's going to be a subjective opinion also. If you're in WWE, they're going to lean toward bigger people. Which means, well, what about smaller people? You know, AJ Styles, who was originally offered a development deal at WWE and chose to go with the startup TNA instead,
mm-hmm.
would AJ Styles have been one of the top guys in the business if he had gone with WWE? Would they have given him the rocket ship up his butt? Or was he developed better at the startup with all the struggle to now, you know, 10 years later, be considered one of the top guys in the business and, according to Pro Wrestling Illustrated several years ago, the number one guy.
Mm-hmm.
You never know. You know, I think AJ had it from the first time I worked with him. Yeah. there was some stuff we had to fix, and he's the first to acknowledge it now, although at the time he didn't agree. But he had it. And there's a lot of other people, whether, you know, Mike Posey as a referee had it, and he's developing it as a wrestler. Patrick Bentley, a kid I'm working with now, has it. Luke Hawks, Alter Boy Luke, had it his whole career, at least, you know, these people, Gunner has it. People, when they come through the curtain, there's a response. The audience can't seem to stop. Whether that translates into them getting over in a bigger theater then depends on how they're positioned and timing and then the fickle audience.
Sure.
Because the audience is inevitably going to decide who's popular.
Well,
no matter how much we try to force the issue, you can't force popularity. You can give it a good push, but you can't force it.
I was going to ask you, what are your thoughts on the internet fan base?
I think the internet fan base gets a little full of itself sometimes in terms of its opinion and forgets that they are not as much part of the business as they are fans of the business, and they sometimes cross a line on their need to be involved in their opinion without the context that they may need. You know, like anything else, you only know what you know by experience,
mm-hmm.
and you only know what you know based on firsthand knowledge. As a given, fans only know what they know. In fact, the internet only knows what it knows. Even the best reporters in quotations on the internet are frequently wrong mm-hmm. in what they learn. And that, you know, that's not necessarily their fault. You know, our news is frequently wrong. You know, heck, they've, you know, news departments have projected winners of elections and gotten it totally wrong historically. So, you know, it's not specifically the internet, but the internet's opened up the quantity of people who believe their opinion matters.
Yeah.
And it doesn't necessarily always matter. And more importantly, it's not necessarily always intelligently presented. That becomes the greatest issue on the internet is there's way too much opinion and not enough of it's intelligent opinion.
Absolutely. But you know, for yourself, first of all, I appreciate the fact that every week you do send out news and notes so that we here at OWW can post that and people that want to learn more about NWA can, you know, find out more about your show. So thank you for sending it out. And it seems like at least you recognize the importance of using social media and the internet to help promote your brand.
Well, I think social media and the internet is essential in a promotional context. In fact, one of the my bitches to wrestlers and promotions and people in general, and if I have to give any advice on social media, it's right now, is just think before you do what you do on Twitter. Think before you do what you do on Facebook. I see way too many people posting their thoughts before they've really thought through those thoughts, whereas if they were one-on-one, they'd be a little more gun-shy or they'd be a little more circumspect in what they were going to do. There's this weirdness about sitting alone, looking at a screen, and you're up on your Facebook, and all of a sudden you're either going to overreact to something, react to something. Twitter's even worse. There have been so many stupid things that have been posted on Twitter by supposedly intelligent people. It boggles my imagination. So I would caution everyone, anytime you have a thought, particularly if it's got a negative connotation, you're grumpy at somebody, don't go immediately to Twitter or to Facebook to voice that concern. Take a breath, walk away, and then decide whether that point was really essential to make. I believe that the best use and at least as it relates to my position in wrestling, for Twitter and Facebook, 99.9% of what I post is promotional.
Mm-hmm.
It's to put somebody over and to try to get greater visibility for that person or to promote something, usually a show, but it could be something else. Rarely am I on expressing an opinion. The only times I have, it's been tied to my job as a booking agent, and I've occasionally posted stuff about deadbeat or sleazy promoters. But that would be the rare area where I get editorial.
You're not going on Twitter every moment telling people what you're eating for breakfast?
No, it amazes me, and this is not to single him out, but I've followed Steve Austin for off and on for a bit, and he entertains me tremendously because he does that. He literally tells you what he's having as a beverage, what he's cooking on the grill, you know, literally how his morning constitutional was to some extent. And you know, it's entertaining to me because there's one of the top stars in the business, and he's gotten sucked in. And you see guys like that. I mean, Hulk Hogan entertains me for the same reason. He's just overly enamored with posting stuff I really don't, you know, nobody's really care about, including him, inevitably. You know, and you wonder what these guys are, you know, these are top celebrities in our business, and yet something makes them go on there and you know, reach out to the people that are, quote, following with not essential information, not stuff that is really interesting, but just stuff. So that part of it I don't get.
In the news and notes that you send out each week, there is a link there to an NWA documentary. I have not checked that yet. If someone was going to check out the documentary, what is that? What would they see?
There's some kids out of the Carolinas who basically wanted to do a documentary on the NWA. Executive Bob Trowbridge blessed it. Not that we have to. I mean, documentaries can be produced about anything by anybody. Gosh knows, you know, Michael Moore, I'm sure, didn't get GM's permission to do his first documentary, and I'm pretty sure the Spurlock guy isn't McDonald's best friend, having canceled supersizing and made McDonald's look like all they did was make people fat. So,
right.
You know, anybody could do a documentary on anything and on any brand as long as they're truthful. But these guys, you know, these were people who worked at a TV station in North Carolina up in Raleigh, I believe, and they just decided they wanted to do something to honor the brand and to trace some of the history of the world title primarily. And I participated and did an interview, and a lot of other wrestlers and people did, and High Spots provided some footage. I provided some footage. Not everybody in our organization thinks it's a good idea. Some people think we should be paid something for it. And then, you know, we have to remind those people that, hey, it's a documentary. You know, but good news is the producers are going to send us all DVDs, and it'll be available for sale by them at some point, and probably available at member shows coming up. So I'm looking forward to seeing the final product. I've just seen the teases like everybody else, so I really don't know what the end product's going to be, but based on the teases, I'm interested.
Mm-hmm. Can you explain your company, Show Business, Inc.?
I set up Show Business, Inc. in 1989, give or take. I had been in the television business, well, my whole life. My family was in the business, and I had become a television syndicator, a guy that put TV shows on TV stations, first nepotistically in sort of a Garrett Bischoff sense. And I was selling TV shows from my dad, something I said I'd never do, but I found I had an aptitude for it and actually liked the travel at the time, although now I hate travel. But at the time, I was, you know, 5 days a week on the road, bouncing from town to town, convincing them to take a children's show my dad did that was called Kids World. And I finally plateaued on what I could do for my dad and literally resigned from the family company at Christmas, which is always the best timing, you know, pick that as the day to hand a resignation note to your dad. But I've always been good at timing. But then I was picked up by a guy named Rich Colbert, who's still in the business, who was involved in a company called Access Syndication that was doing some fairly substantial products. We syndicated, among other things, you know, the Motown specials, including the one Michael Jackson did his famous moonwalk in. So it's, you know, it's a really good product. But that company went bankrupt because the company selling the commercial time went bankrupt. And all of a sudden, I had had one job. I had a good salary. Things were going great. We were successful. And I'm out of a job and owed money by these people. And there was no way I was going to get it because everything was in bankruptcy. And that was a, well, crap moment. And so what I decided was never to be unemployed again. And I figured the only way to do that is the more employed I would be, the less unemployed I would be.
Mm-hmm.
So I set up my own company, Show Business, Inc., which basically was me, although I've had assistance at various times throughout, depending on the money I'm making. And sort of without trying very hard, which is a blessing, people came to me to do stuff. A company wanted me to set their company up. That was my first job, called the Greater Entertainment Company. Then the guy I had worked for at Access, the actual owner of the company, felt bad because he couldn't pay me back, and he gave me a contact. And for several years, I ran a company called World Sports that was the first distributor to television stations of live NASCAR racing.
Oh.
And so I had that I was doing. And then I had a kid named Dave Morgan come to me, and I became his executive vice president and set up a company called Litton Syndications, and we did a show that got fairly popular called Jack Hanna's Animal Adventures, which was first called Zoo Life. And on and on. And then finally, a friend I had brought into the business years ago hired me to replace somebody at what was first called ITC, then became Polygram, then was purchased by Universal Television, and I stayed with them as a director in the Southeast. And all these jobs crisscrossed each other as I wouldn't allow myself to be exclusive. So at various times, I was employed by four, five, six different people, including substantial companies like Universal Television.
Mm-hmm.
Well, finally, Universal Television said they needed me exclusive. I didn't end up taking the deal for reasons that are more silly than smart, perhaps. I didn't want to. They wanted me to travel 5 days a week. I'd been ranked as their top salesperson, they told me. And I traveled 2 days a week and had the highest clearance level for programming. They wanted me to travel 5 days a week. I said, and the money was great. And I said, why five? Well, we need you out there nurturing relationships. I said, well, I've been doing this for 20 years. Nobody wants to see me anymore. That's why they give me deals. That way I don't come visit them. You know, just it was. And we had a headbutting on their need for me to do what everybody else was doing, even if I didn't need to.
Mm-hmm.
And that was stupid to me. So I said goodbye to $150,000 and a budget for an assistant and an office and all sorts of fun stuff and continued doing things on my own. Well, over time, the TV business that I was doing in show business, the piece by piece, producer by producer, going to station, the industry changed. There was consolidation. Instead of individual general managers and program directors making decisions on a local level, corporate decisions were made. Sinclair Broadcasting would be a great example. They got to the point where to get on their air for some things, you had to pay them. Because they controlled so many stations and so many markets, then the rules changed, and the quantity of stations any one owner could have increased. Well, with more consolidation, the job I had, which used to be me going into a local market where there's four or five stations and convincing somebody to take my show, now the job was going in once the show is cleared and making sure everybody's still happy
mm-hmm.
and that they want to keep your show. It was a totally different business. And the ability to generate real revenues or to get paid as a syndicator individually, the way I was doing it, without working for one company, the job I had turned down, became more difficult. Somewhere along the line, and it was actually 1993, the door opened to get involved in professional wrestling, initially just with USWA and Jerry Jarrett and Jeff Jarrett, originally to find markets for Jeff Jarrett to promote. Unfortunately, Jeff didn't want to promote, so Jerry and I set up another relationship that lasted till 97 when USWA went out of business, where we found other people to pay me. And those people were WWE several times under contract and WCW, where I consulted to their syndication for a while and delivered a program. And over that time, the more I got into the wrestling business, the less I was able to be in the television business because of how it was changing.
Sure.
So my television experience moved me into wrestling, where full-time I am now. You know, even though I'm still TV boy in what I do, I'm not the syndicator I was. But that's how show business got started. It became the umbrella for everything.
Well, congratulations on your success and the success of the NWA. You got stars like Colt Cabana, Jeff G. Bailey, Sean Tempers. It seems like the NWA is in good shape. Bill, before we let you go here, though, you have one interesting friend I'd like to talk about, New Jack. What is one thing that pro wrestling fans don't know about New Jack?
That he really is a caring, sensitive guy, which you would never imagine with him. He's also funny as crap. It's a dumb story, but we did an angle with him in Wildside where he raced after a car and got dragged through the parking lot, and he let go of the car, and we didn't know he was going to do it. He improvised it. We just knew we were shooting him. I said, race after the truck. The truck's going to take off. Off you go. He decided to grab a hold of the truck and get dragged. That was his decision. And when I found him, he was laying in a mud puddle. I mean, just disgusting. And he looked up at me, and it, with a very serious face, he went, "My underwear is gooey." And, you know, he just, what do you do? Another time, he got into a fight with a guy that, you know, had done some jobs for WCW stuff, a guy named Rusty Riddle. And the fight lasted all of about 30 seconds, and a guy named Onyx and I pulled New Jack off. And, you know, it had been really violent, and Jack's arm was bleeding from something else, and he just got pissed off, and he's going crazy. And when we pull him off, he turns to me and he goes, "Thank God I was blown up." Yes. So that's the New Jack I know. You know, in fact, he lived on my couch for a couple of weeks at one point. And, you know, and Jack's the only negatives on Jack, he'll admit to this day, are things he did to himself. He's been his own worst enemy. He's learned as a result, because now he's a little more beat up than he was, and he has to be a whole lot more careful, and he's become, you know, a calmer guy. That doesn't mean he can't occasionally get into a fight, which he's done twice recently. You know, he got into a small fight with Brian Knobs, but, you know, go figure, Brian is interesting. And then he got into a fight recently with Balls Mahoney that had been brewing for a while, but... in general, I've never had an issue with Jack. Other people have been scared of him, have been afraid to book him, have thought he was going to be difficult. Even when he's had temper issues, I've been able to calm him down. And he and I have always had a very good relationship. He's one of my favorite people and very, very talented. He's one of the greatest promos our business has ever seen off the top of his head. He is brilliant.
Where can people find the NWA online? Do you have a Twitter, a Facebook, a website?
Yeah, there's the NWA Wrestling Facebook page, also nwawrestling.org, the O-R-G at the end. You can find us and fairly regularly updated. And then a lot of the websites are nice enough, including yours, to publish our weekly notes that we hope keep everybody up to speed on what's going on in their neck of the woods as best we can. Mm-hmm. We've got a lot of people promoting the brand, so there's a lot of opportunities to see wrestling branded as NWA all over the world, literally.
Well, again, congratulations on your success, and thank you for taking the time to join us today on OWW Radio.
Thank you for having me.
Take care. We'll talk to you soon.
Thank you.
And don't forget to check out the OWW website at onlineworldofwrestling.com for the latest news, analysis, and updates from the world of professional wrestling. While you're there, you can also catch up on past episodes of OWW Radio. You can email us at radio@onlineworldofwrestling.com to submit topics or questions you would like us to discuss on an upcoming broadcast. Also, make sure to follow us on Twitter at OWWCOM to get all program updates and announcements. We'll also be posting directly to the official OWW Facebook homepage. Thank you again to NWA Director Mr. Bill Behrens for joining us today. Alex and I will be back next week with a new edition of OWW Radio. All right, well that's the